I'm Mark Prezel, and this is Cincinnati Edition. The next guest in the Cincinnati Zoo's Barrows Conservation Lecture Series is evolutionary biologist and writer Dr. Olivia Judson. Her acclaimed book, Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation, has been translated into 15 different languages. She's on the phone to talk to Thane Maynard this morning.
Dr. Olivia Judson, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. How are you doing?
Very well. Thanks for taking a few minutes. And all of us are excited about your talk at the Cincinnati Zoo coming up next week. So it's been a long time. I've been a big admirer of your writings, obviously your books, but also your column, The Wild Side, in the New York Times. And tell us a bit how a serious scientist ended up writing for the general public.
Well, I sort of got seduced along the way. I was in the middle of finishing my PhD, and things were not going very well, which at the time I didn't realize was normal for a scientist. And I started freelancing, in fact, for The Economist. And then once I finished my PhD, I ended up working at The Economist full-time and never really looked back.
No kidding. Now, in addition to that, my understanding is you're also a professor at Imperial College in London?
I'm not a professor. I have a loose association with them. So it would be an overstatement to say that I'm a professor. I'm loosely associated with them. When I was in London, I had office space, and I still use the library access through them. But it's not a teaching position. It's not a paid position. So it's probably better to put it as a loose affiliation.
Now, I've heard you referred to as Charles Darwin in high heels. So here's a serious evolutionary biologist, and yet you're writing for The Economist?
I started writing full-time for The Economist when I finished my PhD, and then I ended up quitting after about 3 years, although I liked it there very much, in order to think about evolutionary questions. And I went on to write a book based on some very slow thoughts. It took me 4 years from start to finish to write my book, and the one that I'm working on at the moment seems to be taking rather longer.
Well, I know that your first book, or the first one I'm familiar with, Dr. Tatiana's, turned into a BBC television show or others, and I mean, it was quite a hit, and good natural history, good science, but also told in a way that's accessible to everyone.
It was great fun to do Dr. Tatiana, and making the television program was one of the most entertaining periods of my life. I found myself wearing a white leather mini suit and being in a science documentary musical, which wasn't anything I had ever anticipated would happen to me.
But it's a good way to take serious science to the general public. Tell us a bit, if you can, about your book you're working on now.
Well, as I said, it's progress is my current rate of progress. I seem to be working on geological time, so at my current rate of progress, I'll be ready in about a million years. But it's a book that's the easiest way to describe it is as a history of the planet, but it isn't quite that. I've become extremely interested in the interaction between living organisms and the planet, in particular the extent to which living organisms have made the planet what it is today. And I want to give you a quick example. If around dusk, there's a time that photographers call the blue hour. It's when you get, it's just after sunset when the sky turns that sort of deep blue violet color.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it turns out that if you were to turn the clock back 3 billion years, the Earth being 4.6 billion years old. So if you turn it back just over half of its history and you were watching a sunset, the sky would not turn that dark blue. It would turn yellow. And the reason for that is that the ozone layer is responsible for the dark blue-violet color at dusk. And at that time in the Earth's history, it had not yet been created yet because living organisms hadn't made it. The ozone layer and the oxygen we breathe are just two examples of things that living organisms have made that the rest of us are now consuming and benefiting from. And I've become extremely interested in the extent to which both living organisms have made the planet what it is today, but also the extent to which every single being here is actually a manifestation of the planet as it is now, as well as being an echo of its past. And so I've become very preoccupied with that.
Absolutely. And, of course, your career, much of it that people like me would be familiar with, are taking those very complex concepts and making them accessible to the rest of us. For instance, your column that was frequently done in the New York Times called The Wild Side, can we look forward to that returning at some point?
I hope so. I very much enjoyed it. It was a great privilege to be writing about evolution in the New York Times on a weekly basis, but it almost half killed me as well because it was great fun but also very demanding. But I'm hoping I will return to it once my book is finished. That's my plan anyway.
Now, I know you've lived much of your life in England, but also some in the States, and you may know this or might not from living overseas. The question of evolution and evolutionary biology is still a question among many Americans. Of course, non-scientists, but it still can make the headlines in an argument about school curriculum.
Yes, I find it very puzzling. I think that to anyone who has thought about it, studied it, and really reflected, not only is it obviously the case that evolution happens, but also it's an extremely awesome and uplifting way to look at the world, and one that has profound consequences for how we understand our place in nature.
Absolutely. As Darwin said, there's grandeur in this view of life. Your new book's coming out, as you said, you're not certain when. Maybe give us a peek into what you might talk about next week when you're talking here in Cincinnati.
Well, one of the things I want to talk about is the extent to which fire, for example, is a consequence of the activities of living organisms. Fire has only existed on the planet for the last 400 million years, so just really a fraction of the Earth's history, a small fraction, maybe 10% of the Earth's history. And, for example, you couldn't have a fire on Mars. And the reason you can't have a fire on Mars is that, first of all, there's not enough oxygen to sustain fire, and second, there isn't anything to burn. And so you only get fire starting on Earth once you have land plants, and so you have something that can be burned, and you have an oxygen levels high enough to support fire. And I think this is interesting also because fire has played such an important part in human evolution, our evolution in particular. We could argue that humans are not the wise apes, but the cooking apes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're the only organisms that have evolved to control fire. We don't always manage to do it, but at the same time, we can do it, and we can use fire as a way to clear rainforest, for example. But we can also use fire to cook, and the onset of cooking, first of all, changed human social life, but second, also had an enormous impact on our own physiology. It shortened our guts, made our teeth smaller, our faces smaller, and in general has allowed us to almost certainly to evolve intelligence because it gave us access to more calories for less effort.
You know, that's fascinating, and that's one of the reasons it's fun to talk with you briefly on this interview is just what you had just spoken about opened up an idea that I'd never thought of that, you know, it hasn't been that long in human, well, it has in human history, but not in geologic history, that there's been fire on Earth, and that's the kind of thing most people would not think of, but the way you explained it makes total sense. And reminds me of the book by Richard Wrangham, whom I'm sure is a colleague of yours, called Catching Fire. But you put it in two sentences what I had to read 350 pages to see.
Well, to be fair to him, he talks a lot more about different human cultures than I just did.
Exactly, exactly. Well, this will be fun. I appreciate you coming next week. I appreciate you taking time on this. Catch us up a bit on your sort of whereabouts. If you're not at Imperial College, are you living in London?
Okay, so I remain affiliated with Imperial College, but I'm presently in the United States. My father died almost 2 years ago, and I have been in the process very slowly of emptying the family house. I realized the other day that I was taking several hours to decide the fate of a single sheet of paper, so that might be why I'm still here 2 years later.
And yet I read your very good op-ed about that process that was in the Times a month or two ago, so
you've
continued to do great work. And I'll plan on seeing you next week, and listeners are certainly welcome to come as well on Wednesday, May 1st, 7 p.m. at the zoo. So, Olivia Judson, thank you.
Thanks very much. I'm looking forward to it.
My guest has been Dr. Olivia Judson. For the Cincinnati Edition, I'm Thane Maynard.